A historic low today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. The Trump administration wants to reduce the number of refugees admitted to the U.S. each year to only 45,000.
This 45,000 number is actually the lowest refugee admissions goal we've ever had as a country.
We'll hear how that could add years to the already long refugee resettlement process. Plus, Rohingya refugees take to the streets of Chicago to protest abuses back home in Myanmar.
Every Americans and Chicagoan, please stand with us. Please, we need your help.
And rejoice, city of Townsville. There's a new Powerpuff Girl with a South African voice.
She's tall. She's older than the other girls. She's got some hips. She's got skin like mine.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thank you for being with us today. We're going to start the program with a group of people we often talk about, refugees. The news from Washington is that the Trump administration is cutting the number of refugees allowed into the U.S. each year to only 45,000. That's down from a high of 110,000 in Obama's last year in office. Jen Smyers is the policy director for the Church World Services Refugee Program. The group helps resettle refugees in the United States. Smyers says that in reducing the number of refugees, Trump is following through on a promise.
Certainly, President Trump on the campaign trail and in his executive order has made it clear that he doesn't necessarily agree with the components of the refugee resettlement program that really are a beacon of light to the world and are founding principles of our nation. We also know from reading articles that Stephen Miller played a large role in determining that number, and it seems to have been
Trump's
made more
advisor.
As a political. That's right. It seems to be made more as a political decision this year than the type of foreign policy, national security, and programmatic decision that it has been in all years past.
Which refugees will be impacted most by this drawdown of refugee numbers to the U.S.?
Refugees will be impacted really at all steps of the process and from all the nationalities that we're expecting refugees to be resettled from. Certainly refugees from Syria, Iraq, Eritrea, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Somalia will all be impacted. Individuals who were supposed to come this year but didn't because the administration's executive order set the refugee admissions number so low will not even be able to come in next year because, again, you're talking about another very, very low refugee admissions goal for next year. So people who were starting the process and were looking at a three-year wait to hold on during those 3 years for an opportunity for safety now will have to be waiting, you know, 6 years or even more for any type of relief. So it's impacting not only tens of thousands of lives in the immediate term, but even more thousands of lives in the long term because everyone waiting for an opportunity for safety will be bumped back.
And Jen, what do you think the impact of this new 45,000 cap on refugees will be when you couple it with the travel ban?
So there are a myriad of implications that have, in some cases, already taken place. I mean, we're really seeing this administration wreak havoc on the entire refugee resettlement program. People's security checks have already expired between the back and forth of the various bans. And certainly those who were anticipating being able to reunite with family or being able to finally find safety will now be waiting much longer. And it's not only those individual lives, even though that's obviously the most important, it's also our relationships with our allies and refugee hosting countries, countries like Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, Kenya, who are hosting, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions in some cases, refugees. To say to them, the U.S. is backing away from our commitment while we're expecting our allies to do more is certainly not in keeping with our usual status as leader in the world.
So, Jen, in an ideal world for you and for Church World Service, what do you think the cap should be? What's the number?
Well, certainly we would like to see a number much closer to 200,000, especially during this global refugee crisis. But at a bare minimum, this administration should be resettling 75,000, which would still be low when you look at the historic average, but would at least not be setting the lowest goal ever right now, and is really paramount to keeping this program's capacity going.
Jen Smyers, Policy Director for the Church World Services Refugee Program. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to focus now on one group of refugees in the United States and what's really at stake when a cap is placed on their numbers. I'm talking about a small, embattled group of people from Myanmar called the Rohingya.
UN, United Nations, and every Americans and Chicagoan, please stand with us. Please, please raise your voice. We need your help. Please stand for us.
That's at a recent demonstration of Rohingya in Chicago, one place in the U.S. where a small community of refugees has settled. Back home, their families and friends are fleeing from what they say is a systematic campaign of violence being carried out by the Burmese military. The U.N. says 500,000 Rohingya Muslims have crossed the border into Bangladesh. Journalist Ryan Schisler was recently at the Rohingya Cultural Center in Chicago.
There's a large prevalent sense of hopelessness. A lot of people are very worried about their friends and relatives in Myanmar and are struggling to find a way to feel like they can make a difference. A lot of people are hearing from their immediate families about the dangers there. But in addition to that, this center has also been a touchstone for this community as it's grown. And so there's everyday activities going on, from ESL classes to job coaching, as well as just people hanging out and visiting. It's really become a community center here.
I mean, those Rohingya in Chicago who do have family who are in danger, I mean, they must be really beside themselves.
That's right. A lot of the people who I met voiced serious concern for their relatives. Some have already found out that their parents or siblings have been killed. I spoke to one young man, Abdul Samad, about his mother and sisters who are still in the country.
Yes, I do. I do have my mom and my siblings still in Burma.
Do you know if they're safe?
I'm not sure, because it's every day burning villages, every day killing people, killing children, raping women. So I don't know, today's life, maybe tomorrow will be die.
Wow, he sounds really desperate. So meantime, the Rohingyas in Chicago are also holding demonstrations to try and draw attention to the crisis back home. What are those like, and are people paying attention?
That's right. There was one just this last Saturday. The Rohingya Community Center organized school buses to transport a couple hundred protesters from the city's far north side right to the downtown area. There was 2 hours of programming and demonstrating and chanting, activists who showed up in solidarity from other organizations. And a lot of the members of this community were walking around the streets of Chicago, passing out literature, even if their English skills weren't so much that they can communicate with pedestrians. And there were quite a few people walking by who stopped to talk, to watch. Some even stayed and held up signs. But unfortunately, quite a large number of them just walked on.
So I'm just curious, outside of these demonstrations of Rohingya solidarity, how visible is the community in Chicago? Like, do they have an economic base? Do they have restaurants, anything like that?
No, this community is still relatively new. It's about 1,000 to 1,200 people split between around 400 families, and the vast majority of them have only arrived within the last 5 years. The community center is really the only physical space for them right now.
So the other thing, as you know, there's been a lot of talk about whether Burmese Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi should have her Peace Prize revoked for basically refusing to do anything or say anything about the crisis. How did the people you spoke with feel about her?
They are very angry with her. The anger was really quite palpable at this demonstration. People invoked her name specifically and called on her to do more. Some compared her and other high-ranking members of Myanmar's military to the Nazis. And there were times during this protest where people would start ripping up her photo or throwing it on the ground and stomping their feet on it or grinding it into the pavement with their heel. The anger is very, very apparent.
What does this small community of Rohingya in Chicago actually want?
They, as far as I can tell, are looking really to counter the rhetoric that is fueling this violence in Myanmar. They have a message that, you know, their families have been in that country for generations, that they are not terrorists, that they are Muslims, not terrorists. But they also want the United States government and the United Nations to do more to help the Rohingya. Amongst the people I spoke to, one of the common refrain was a UN peacekeeping force to protect the people who were facing this violence and fleeing to Bangladesh. But there are lots of questions about why the United States, which they see as a very powerful country, has been so silent and done so little so far.
Journalist Ryan Schisler, recently in Chicago, exploring the Rohingya community there. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
The Rohingya, or Rohingya as some call the people, live mainly in Burma's Rakhine State. Author Andrea Pitzer had been to Rakhine to research her new book, One Long Night. She says the Rohingya-only enclaves in that part of the country are 21st century versions of concentration camps.
It's mass detention, large groups of people living almost in barrack-style housing with guards and checkpoints.
So would that be classified as a concentration camp? Isn't it more of a transit camp as these people are fleeing the area that they live in?
Well, they weren't built to be transit camps as they fled. They were built to hold them. And in theory, originally, 5 years ago, were supposed to be temporary, and they would be reintegrated back into their communities after rioting and the violence had settled. But it's clear now the government doesn't have a plan or an intention to bring them out of there. And so the fact they're not allowed to come and go, they've been there 5 years, and they're only fleeing now actually out of northern villages, not camps, as the villages are being burned down, I think do make them part of a punitive concentration camp strategy.
When you went to these camps that the Rohingya are in, where did you go? What did you find?
I flew from Yangon, formerly known as Rangoon, which is the big city most people think of if they know anything about Myanmar. And I went to Sitwe, which is the state capital of Rakhine State on the western side of Myanmar. And it's a very rural, extremely poor state. So not just the Rohingya are poor, but everyone there is poor.
We've heard about Rakhine State, but I've heard little about the Rakhine people. And you kind of dig into this. And the narrative is that it's the Buddhist majority army of Myanmar that's going after these Muslim Rohingya. But it sounds also like there's an internal struggle between the Rakhine people and the Rohingya. Is the Myanmar government just letting that play out?
Actually, there's kind of two levels, as you noted. There's this long-term animosity that's local, that now that there's finally democratic government, these Rakhine people, they want to have control over Rakhine State, and they see the Muslims as a threat to that.
So who are the Rakhine people?
They are Buddhist, and they have deep historical roots in the state. They control the state legislature and just see themselves as being threatened by this growing Muslim population that they see as really being from Bangladesh. They don't even call them Rohingya. They don't recognize that word.
What does the central government in Myanmar think about the Rakhine people?
I had heard various people refer to them as snakes in the grass, as drug traffickers, the equivalent of hayseeds. The parallel situation, and I don't want to make it too parallel, but one could see it as not unlike perhaps the Deep South in the 1950s or 1960s in the Jim Crow era.
So these Rakhine people are the ones jailing and harassing the Rohingya, is that right?
They're not necessarily the guards on the camps, but they're the reason the government has kept those camps in place. Their resistance to reintegrating the Rohingya population, I think, has led the federal government to just kind of want to leave the situation where it is.
It's not black and white, though. You say the camp detainees were emphatic about wanting detention to be lifted so they could come and go at will, but they did not seem to mind the armed protection and at times expressed gratitude for his presence. Does that suggest, do you think, Andrea, that if they leave the camp, they would be killed?
It seemed difficult even when I was there in 2015 to imagine the two communities being reintegrated. Now, it's even harder to imagine. I think that there would have to be federal involvement. I think it would be a huge effort, and there would likely be more violence. But I don't think that gets you out of having to deal with the situation.
What do you think would happen to Aung San Suu Kyi if she were to come out unequivocally to state that the camps need to close and the violence against the Rohingya needs to stop?
I don't want to step too far out of my wheelhouse because I'm not an Aung San Suu Kyi expert. I think there would be a massive reaction in the country. This idea of Buddhist nationalism is very strong right now. And it's not just in Myanmar. Right now, worldwide, there's this kind of reactionary phenomenon that we're facing. So I don't want to pretend that she's got an easy situation on her hands.
Andrea Pitzer's new book is called One Long Night, A Global History of Concentration Camps. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, the Powerpuff Girls get a plus one. You're with the world.
I like words.
A podcast.
Crunchy, crackly words.
About language.
Trixie, Tucker, Gentile.
The world in words.
Oh, heavens, my gracious landsake words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. Equatorial Guinea. If you don't know much about it, fair enough. This tiny country tucked into the coastline of West Africa doesn't get a lot of coverage. One of the reasons is pretty simple. No independent media is allowed there. But that hasn't stopped Ramon Esono Ebale. He's a cartoonist, and for years he's challenged and exposed the dictatorship of President Teodoro Obiang Nguema Mbasogo. But 12 days ago, Ebale was arrested. Journalist Rowan Moore Garrity has written about Ebale's activism in the past. He says the cartoonist has never been afraid to take aim at the president and his family.
Really, they've managed to hold on through very, very severe political repression. That has ebbed and flowed at different points. but his family basically controls all important sectors of the economy. They have a very active secret police, and they really don't tolerate any dissidents. People who speak out are either imprisoned or very quickly find a way to get out of the country.
What about Ramon and what he writes for his audience? Like, how does he connect with his readers in Equatorial Guinea and the diaspora? I mean, he left Equatorial Guinea in 2011, lived in Paraguay for many years. Has his exile been beneficial, or has it hurt him in terms of getting his message across?
I think it's been beneficial just because I really have a hard time imagining how somebody could put out anywhere near the quantity of work or the really strident tenor that his work in exile has had. My sense is that it's kind of unleashed him as an artist just because obviously it does insulate him from any backlash. The book that has gotten him in trouble most recently called Obi's Nightmare. And basically it imagines Teodoro Obiang, the president, waking up one morning and discovering that he is just another lowly resident of Malabo, living in a shack that leaks without any running water, with an angry wife who sends him out to sort of face the indignities of the market. And he goes on this sort of awful day-long adventure where he ends up in jail and goes through all of these terrible things that a normal citizen might have to go through in the course of daily life there.
Right. So that's Obi's Nightmare. So how's Ramon distributing a book like that in Equatorial Guinea?
So there are about 200 copies, from what I know, on paper that have made it into the country. It's also been circulating on USB keys, you know, in electronic format among some young people and activists there. The tricky thing is you can't react publicly to a book like that. So it's a little bit hard to sort of gauge the reaction because the people who are reading it can't just go post on social media or talk to their friends openly. But, you know, I think Ramon's view is there's always got to be somebody who's willing to push the envelope. And what he said to me about Obi's Nightmare and about some of that work was, I'm trying to get people to laugh, to kind of break the stranglehold that Obiang has on his own image in society. People think of him like God, is what he told me. And we need to be able to make fun of him so that people realize that something beyond Obiang is possible for this country.
So Ramon Esono has been charged with counterfeiting. It seems like a trumped-up charge, but it's kind of hard to know what that's all about. Tell us what you know about the conditions at the jail where he's being kept.
So the prison is called Black Beach, and it was pretty notorious after independence as the main place that political prisoners were sent. Torture was commonplace, and even today there are reports of inmates being denied medical treatment and being denied food, but it's just hard to know. The sense I've gotten is that what the Obiang regime is waiting for is some kind of more full-throated apology, which even if it isn't really credible, would at least be viewed as kind of a victory. In the past, opposition politicians have been made to put T-shirts with the president's face on them and go on national television renouncing what they'd said. What I know about Ramon suggests that he really would be loath to do something like that and would fight it with every ounce of his being. But he's got a family living halfway across the world now, and it's got to be a terribly scary situation. In the past, this is something where advocates for human rights, you know, might have contacted the State Department desk and gotten a statement written. I was told that so far they have heard nothing from the U.S. Embassy in Equatorial Guinea.
Rowan Moore Garrity, a journalist who's written a long and very engaging story about the cartoon activism of Ramon Esono Ebale of Equatorial Guinea. Rowan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Check out some of Ramon Esono Ebale's provocative cartoons over at PRI.org. And this next story keeps us in the world of cartoons, and it comes courtesy of our Across Women's Lives desk. Depending on when you grew up, or your kids grew up, or how old you are in your head, you might remember this show.
Once again, the day is saved. Thanks to the Powerpuff Girls.
The Powerpuff Girls, that Cartoon Network show about three sisters, Buttercup, Blossom, and Bubbles, who use their superpowers to fight crime. The show went off the air a while back, and I'll admit it, I've really missed the evil Mojo Jojo.
Annoying little girl, you must wait your turn, in which I am first and you are second, which in essence makes you last, since one is before two.
Well, you can stop your sobbing. The Powerpuff Girls are back for a one-hour special. Yes. But now a fourth Powerpuff Girl has been added to the family, and she is black.
Okay, so the new character I'm playing is called Bliss. She's tall. She's older than the other girls. She's got some hips. She's got skin like mine.
That's Toya DeLazy, one of 15 different voice actors across the globe who will play Bliss, the POC, the Powerpuff of color. In the U.S., Bliss will be voiced by Cartoon Network veteran Olivia Olson.
My powers are dangerous! That's why you should let me out!
In New Zealand and Australia, she'll be played by a YouTube star named Wengi.
You guys really think I can be a Powerpuff Girl?
And in Africa, she'll be voiced by Toya DeLazy.
Nobody messes with my sisters.
Cartoon Network says they hired different actresses to play Bliss, even in different English-speaking regions of the world, just so more people would connect with the character. Toya DeLazy takes that pretty seriously. She's even put many of her own mannerisms into the role.
I don't think Blossom, Bubbles, and Buttercup suck teeth. I mean, that's quite an African thing to, you know, that's our thing. You know, so there's moments like that, which when an African kid is watching, they'll understand what's going on.
The reaction to the new character has been mixed, shall we say. For some, it's a step towards more diversity. Others see it as a half-hearted marketing gimmick. As for DeLazy?
I think everything else can wait when it comes to that. It's been a great move. I'm excited. Cartoon Network made my dreams come true. That's all I can say.
DeLazy says she grew up watching Cartoon Network, and the Powerpuff Girls meant a lot to her.
It was just young girls kicking ass on TV. So, and there were superheroes. And for a girl, you know, especially where I was from, KwaZulu-Natal, it's not often that girls are, you know, bringing the noise like that.
And now Toya DeLazy gets to bring that noise, as are women from all over the world, at least for an hour.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Powerpuff Girls fighting crime.
Toya DeLazy there singing a version of the theme song for the Powerpuff Girls for Cartoon Network Africa.
We've got the power, we got the power. Break it through the walls, we gotta do it all. We don't quit, we don't quit. We've got the power, we got the power. Flying high in the sky above.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to what you're missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Banana farmers in Peru battle the elements.
We just don't know how much it will rain. And here we had 12 hours, 16 hours of rain a day. Way too much water to do anything about.
After 2 years of unpredictable rains and droughts, Peru's farmers tried to adapt to a new normal. That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. A little more than a week ago, a 7.1 magnitude earthquake flattened buildings in Mexico City. Outside the capital, homes collapsed across the south-central Mexican states of Morelos and Puebla. But remember that there was another quake that hit southern Mexico back on September 7th, and thousands of aftershocks continue to shake that region. Shannon Young reports from Oaxaca.
A group of people on a corner in the hard-hit city of Juchitán are looking at what's left of once-familiar buildings. They collapsed Saturday morning during a 6.1 magnitude aftershock here that jolted residents across Oaxaca out of bed. Two men say what a lot of people are thinking here, that Saturday's was the worst of the thousands of aftershocks that have been rocking the region since the 8.2 earthquake hit on September 7th. The Saturday morning shaking collapsed a bridge and toppled several structures that had been damaged but were still standing after September 7th. It also sent people back into the streets or onto their patios to sleep, eat, and otherwise feel safer than inside their homes.
Alerta sísmica. Alerta sísmica.
Saturday morning's tremor set off seismic alarms as far away as Mexico City. For many, it was the third time in as many weeks that an earthquake measuring above a magnitude 6 sent them running outside.
Esto, la comunidad científica lo está estudiando de entrada por la lejanía y por tanto.
Mexico's National Seismological Service Director, Xoli Pérez Campos, told reporters that the scientific community says it's unlikely there's any direct relation between the September 7th quake and the one closer to Mexico City on the 19th. The two occurred along different fault lines in separate parts of the country. But she adds that scientists do agree that Saturday's 6.1 quake was an aftershock, the strongest of the more than 5,000 aftershocks the National Seismological Service has registered from the 8.2 earthquake. The constant movements have people in the isthmus on edge. This is a region without a seismic alert system, so residents rely on their senses or visual cues like swaying power lines to gauge the intensity of an aftershock, or even just confirm that it happened.
Sigue temblando, no pegamos el ojo para nada, porque pues estamos al pendiente de correr.
In a shelter in San Dionisio del Mar, Monica Torres says the intermittent shaking and related need to stay on one's toes means no one's getting a good night's sleep. She says the anxiety is worsening the health of locals who were already dealing with high blood pressure and diabetes. Sadness, she adds, is everywhere, especially among those who lost their homes. And then there's the change to the diet.
Más puro pescadito recién salido del mar. Comemos.
Neri Sosa says people in San Dionisio del Mar, especially children, aren't used to eating canned food, like what comes in care packages. The town, as its Spanish name suggests, is located along the seaside. But with homes in ruins and aftershocks causing choppy waters, villagers aren't fishing much these days. And the price of fresh produce has skyrocketed. Sosa and Torres help run the community kitchen in the San Dionisio shelter. Over the weekend, they built two traditional wood-burning stoves with donated materials so that people here can once again make tamales, smoked fish, and totopos, a type of flat, perforated tortilla crisp that's a staple in the regional diet. Totopos have been hard to come by since the earthquake destroyed fragile earthenware stoves, as well as the homes of the women who produce totopos on a cottage industry scale. Cooking helps take the edge off the stress, even allowing for moments of laughter. After thousands of aftershocks and weeks of subsisting on canned food, even something as simple as a traditional regional meal can provide some comfort that has been sorely lacking since September 7th. But before people here can even think of getting back to everyday life or rebuilding, the earth first needs to stop shaking. For the world, Shannon Young, Oaxaca, Mexico.
It is day 8 with no electricity in Puerto Rico, and it's not just the electric. Millions of people are also without food and water, and getting supplies to the island has been a slow process. Some officials are blaming the Jones Act for slowing down relief efforts. We talked about this nearly 100-year-old law yesterday on the show, how it places restrictions on how shipping happens between U.S. ports. Today, the Trump administration announced it would temporarily waive those restrictions. But we're still a little puzzled by the Jones Act, so we asked Rockford Weitz to help us out on some of the details. He's a professor at Tufts in the Maritime Studies program there. Professor Weitz, just remind us quickly, what is the Jones Act?
So the Jones Act is a 1920 law that regulates the carriage of goods from one U.S. port to another. And essentially, the requirements are threefold. The vessels have to be flagged in the United States, crewed by U.S. sailors, and built in U.S. shipyards.
So yesterday on the program, during an interview, we entertained a possible scenario that could have played out under the Jones Act. That is, say the Dominican Republic wanted to bring relief supplies to Puerto Rico by sea. They'd have to first go to Jacksonville, Florida, unload the cargo to a Jones Act eligible ship, and then bring that stuff to Puerto Rico. Some listeners wrote in saying no, relief from the DR can go straight to Puerto Rico. So clarify this for us.
The listeners are correct. From the DR to Puerto Rico can go direct.
And why is that?
Because it does not originate in a U.S. port. The Dominican Republic is not a U.S. state or territory.
I see. So exactly how will waiving these restrictions, as we heard today from the White House, how is that going to affect relief efforts with Puerto Rico?
think about who is really interested in sending goods to Puerto Rico. Think of all the Puerto Ricans who live in New York. They want to directly contribute. The Jones Act waiver enables those containers to be uploaded in New York and offloaded in Puerto Rico directly without using a Jones Act carrier.
What about rebuilding efforts in the coming weeks and months? The White House said it would be loosening restrictions for 10 days on the Jones Act. Is that enough time to address the devastating damage the island has faced with its infrastructure?
From my perspective, it's not. And to use something that might resonate in Washington, I would say this is an opportunity to make American shipping great again by improving the Jones Act.
Let's get to that in a second, because I have another question about the Jones Act and how it actually affects us here on the U.S. mainland. Because
yep.
I've read some things that suggest this law has actually raised costs for all Americans in all 50 states. I know you've done some research on this. What have you found?
So the states that are particularly affected by the Jones Act are island states or territories like Puerto Rico and Hawaii. And then those that are effectively islands like Alaska. And if you've been to any of those three places, and I've been to two out of the three, prices are higher.
Mm.
And that is because, in part, to get goods to there from U.S. ports, the carriage of goods, again, has to be flagged in the U.S., which isn't that costly. Crewed by U.S. crew, which isn't that costly either. It's actually the third one that's the most costly, which is it has to be built in U.S. shipyards.
So do you think the Jones Act should be scrapped?
I think it should be improved. I would loosen the third restriction, the U.S. build provision. And so the goal of the Jones Act historically was preserve the U.S. domestic shipping industry. Now, one of the unintended consequences of this is that as globalization happened and the shipbuilding industry moved from the Atlantic to the Pacific and really from Japan to Korea to now China, the cost of building a ship in Pacific Asia is a fraction of the cost to build it here in a U.S. yard. And the U.S. yards just don't have the volume. And therefore, if you're plugged into the global economy like everybody is now, but you're hindered, as an island nation is like Puerto Rico or Hawaii, from receiving U.S. goods, it makes you less competitive. So for Puerto Rico, for example, it is harder for U.S. exporters to export to Puerto Rico than it is to the Dominican Republic right next door.
Mm.
That doesn't make any sense.
And if those updates that you envision were to happen, do you think that would bring costs down for the people of Puerto Rico?
No question. Yes.
Rockford Weitz, Professor Tufts, thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Politics the world over can get really nasty. In Uganda's parliament this week, legislators let their fists do the talking. Yes, lawmakers came to blows twice, and it's all over a proposal to change the maximum age at which a president can serve there. Uganda's current president, Yoweri Museveni, is 73. He's ruled the country for more than 30 years, but Museveni can't run for re-election because Uganda's constitution does not allow a president to be more than 75 years old. Museveni's party wants to change that, and that's where the fistfights and chair-throwing started. Alex John Otto is a reporter with the Uganda Radio Network and witnessed the chaos.
What happened is that opposition members of parliament started singing the Uganda national anthem as a means to buy time, to block the motion from coming up, to block any other activity that would happen. But many of them came aware that they might get suspended. So they had a strategy, and that strategy was, we shall not leave this house. We shall resist whatever form of suspension they bring. So the speaker reads out 24 names and declares that they are suspended. Among the people to be suspended is a minister, because he carried a firearm into the parliament. And instead of moving out, respecting the orders of the speaker, the members of parliament rejected to move out. This forced the speaker to call the sergeant at arms, and many people think and believe that the force used was really uncalled for, as some members of parliament were dragged by their legs on the floor, others were punched. Some 2-3 members of parliament jumped on top of the only table that is in front of parliament, attempting to try and pick an instrument of the speaker's power. And as we speak now, some members of parliament are actually hospitalized.
Alex, how common is fistfighting in the Ugandan parliament?
So it is actually not common. Parliament has rarely had fist fights, but some members of Parliament have been thrown out for things to do with rules of procedures, like abuses and things like that.
It would seem then that this proposal to raise the presidential age limit, why is it such a touchy subject?
Apparently, the president has ruled for 31 years in an election that he claims he honestly and genuinely wins. But many people still question the authenticity of the elections. However, many people think that the age limit is the only break to stop the president from ruling again, and that is supposed to safeguard the democracy of the country, is being tampered with. So many of the members of parliament actually tie on red ribbons and put on red clothing and tops to show that they are willing to shed blood for their country.
Right. Yeah, I was wondering what those red ribbons were all about. So where does this go from here, this whole issue? And as you say, President Museveni has been there for over three decades. So if he really wants the age limit raised, won't he just go ahead and do it himself?
Apparently, the president has been so silent about it, and he has completely distanced himself from it. And it is his appointed members majorly pushing for this. And on where this debate will head, today the members of parliament who support the lifting of the presidential age limit, they were actually calling for stronger punishments for the opposition, saying they have ashamed the country because they have fought in parliament. And there is no semblance of reconciliation, but there is a bit of an interest to show that one side has defeated the other. The opposition on the other side state that they want to make sure this doesn't come to pass. Yeah.
Alex John Otto, a reporter with the Uganda Radio Network, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you too for the call. Thank you.
You can go to some of the most remote parts of the world and find Americana. The death of Hugh Hefner reminded me of the first time I saw the Playboy Bunny in West Africa, a sticker on someone's motorcycle, also on a bottle of some cologne in a Nigerian corner shop. The Playboy Bunny logo may be the greatest global legacy the late Hugh Hefner leaves behind. Some of you may think it's something else. The articles. That is not a joke. There were the photos, but let's face it, the audience for the magazine was pretty exclusively white men. Male chauvinist pig? Well, Hugh Hefner was the one for whom the term was practically invented. In fact, Playboy itself first used the acronym MCP in its pages in 1970. But those articles, specifically, the Playboy interviews, they did have a serious impact. Some of them were news-making. In the 1980s, for example, four Sandinista leaders from Nicaragua, including Daniel Ortega, sat down with Playboy and laid into President Ronald Reagan. They called him a sort of Frankenstein's monster and a madman. A couple of years later, when he was requesting aid to the Contras to fight the Sandinistas, Reagan referred to those Playboy interviews in one of his speeches. Earlier this year, German Chancellor Angela Merkel read an interview Donald Trump gave to Playboy in 1990. German officials say Merkel read it to be better prepared when she first met the U.S. president. Malcolm X, Yasser Arafat, and Fidel Castro all granted interviews to Playboy. And of course, there was the famous Jimmy Carter interview that went viral after he stated that, as a married man, he had looked on a lot of women with lust. "I've committed adultery in my heart many times," Carter told Playboy, a line that some thought might cost him the election. Hugh Hefner, dead at age 91, a legacy that includes bunnies, a grotto, and the occasional big geopolitical splash. Modern Jazz Quartet there on Playboy After Dark, Hugh Hefner's short-lived TV show. I love a good banana, and the organic ones seem to taste better, sweeter. I like to know also where my food comes from, and it's often hard to find out the origin of organic bananas. Turns out that one of the main sources in recent years has been the northern Peruvian town of Piura. But banana farmers there have been hard hit by extreme weather, first drought, then torrential rains. Reporter Tipa Fernandez has been speaking with farmers in the region.
Hear that bird? It's called a chilalo. It's unique to northern Peru, and village elders watch this bird closely to understand what weather might be coming. In the dry season, it builds its complex and fully enclosed nest on the outer branches of the trees. But Jorge Luis Vildoso Garcia has learned to watch for when the chilalos abandon these nests and start to build new ones.
Es lo que dicen los antiguos.
Older villagers who have lived in this area for more than 70 years say that when the chilalo starts to build a new nest, you know, more protected and close to the trunk, well, that's because rains are coming.
You may be a little skeptical, but Garcia, who manages an organic banana farm, is not. When he began seeing chilalo nests disappear from the outer branches late last year, he suspected the rains were coming, which was a relief after such a prolonged drought, the likes of which this region of Peru hasn't seen in decades. And the rains did indeed come, but they were torrential downpours every day for months. It was back-to-back extreme weather events that hit this agricultural region of Peru very hard.
Bueno, gracias. Gracias.
I've had my shoes inspected and dusted off, scrubbed my hands and arms clean, and finally been cleared to walk in this organic banana farm in the northern Peruvian coastal town of Piura.
Este es un ejemplo de una planta afectada.
Garcia's holding up a bunch of bananas, but they're tiny, deformed. He likens banana tree clusters to little families.
Después de muerta la mamá,
so after the mama died in the drought, the child that she sprouted began to drown because of the excessive rains.
Garcia said he lost 50% of his crop to the weather. He probably would have lost more if not for these guys. Bees. His farm is organic, so the bees love his trees because there are no chemicals or fertilizers. They come a lot when the banana plant is flowering and have helped salvage some of the crop, he says.
O sea, las abejas están alimentando.
The bees are feeding themselves and also feeding the plant, and it's all totally natural.
The organic bananas from his farm are bought by Dole and then shipped worldwide, including to the U.S. But the extreme weather didn't just affect banana production. It also stalled transport options along the export route for bananas that did manage to survive and grow.
Last week we had 25 containers that could not be exported to the U.S., and everything in them will be incinerated because they closed the port.
The ocean was too rough, not safe for ferrying out the containers of produce to the export ships. A big company like Dole can mitigate its losses by turning to other sources in Ecuador or Colombia. But that doesn't help Peru's farmers. And Piura's economy has been deeply affected, according to Eduardo Pineda Guerra, Piura's Regional Director for Economic Development.
Here in Piura, in a normal year, our produce contributes to the gross domestic product by about 5%. But this year, we've only managed 2.5%. So this has really affected us. It's hit us very hard.
And it's not just organic bananas that have been decimated by Piura's extreme weather. Limes, mangoes, and grape production are also down. I'm in a vast grape field up in the mountains of Piura with farm manager Cesar Chavez. Grape vines are planted in a mesmerizingly symmetrical pattern. The beauty of the crisscrossing plants masks the fact that most are barren.
Este es el racimo.
He's showing me a bunch of grapes. It took him a while to find one.
Este es un racimo normal.
It's a normal bunch, he tells me, but there are so few of these this year.
Siempre la planta sacaba.
Each plant would usually give us between 80 to 100 bunches of grapes. But this year, because of the weather events, we're not even getting 10 bunches per plant.
Can't he protect his plants from this weather?
Pero prevenir.
You can't prevent this kind of loss on a farm when you're facing unknown weather events. We just don't know how much it would rain. And here we had 12 hours, 16 hours of rain a day, way too much water to do anything about.
It's a long road ahead for Piura's farmers to recover their crops. Everyone is hoping the weather bounces back to what it's always been. But after almost 2 years of ferocious changes, farmers fear this might be the new normal. For its part, the local government wants farmers to have tools to adapt so they can ride out future extreme weather events, which it says are due to something they have little control over, climate change. In October, the government is bringing together experts, climate scientists, agriculturalists, and industry, to try and figure out how this farming region of Peru can rebuild, can thrive. For The World, Deepa Fernandez, Piura, Peru.
We finish up today with Linda Cainde Diaz and Naomi Diaz. They're the French Afro-Cuban duo Ibei. The twin sisters fuse jazz, hip-hop, Yoruba influences, and much, much more. We spoke with them when they released their first album a few years ago, and my time flies. Ibei has a new album dropping tomorrow. It's called Ashes. Here's one of the tracks, Me Voy.
Me tocas y me hunde las olas y me hunde la lluvia. Me besas, sueño y miel en mi boca, sueño y miel en la ropa. Ay, recuerda, recuerda. Y me voy, y me voy, y me voy, y te vas, y te vas.
Me voy, or I'm going, is a bittersweet tune, the longing for a past love, but also seeking the promise of a better tomorrow. Rapping between the vocals and bata drumming is Spanish hip-hop artist Mala Rodriguez.
Ya no tengo frío, ya no tengo miedo en que no tenga mar. A mí me hace solo y ya no quiero mucho, ya no quiero menos que no pueda. Tampoco quiero luego, siento que tengo poco tiempo, yo no quiero perder. Tú me hacías falta, jugué, sin ojos caminé, cualquiera que toma la...
New music from Ibei there, and that'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back tomorrow.
Me miras, soy tuya hasta el amanecer. Se nos agotan las horas. Me olvido, te olvidas al cerrar los ojos. Solo hay melodía.
PRI, Public Radio International.